Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here for the 25th of January. This is our show, part of the Faith Radio Network, where we try to cover the news and the special interest topics of the day from a distinctly Christian perspective of hope. You know, if you listen, we say often that we will fix our eyes on Jesus together, the author and perfecter of our faith, and that remains true yet again today because it is a kingdom that knows no end, and it will be here long after we're gone. It was here long before us, and so it has our allegiance here on the morning show. Glad that you're listening this morning, wherever you are throughout our country. And as we get started this morning, we're going to be joined by Carmen LaBurge here in just a little bit. She's the host of Connecting Faith. And Carmen and I are going to chat through a number of different topics today, including an app that the Pope has released for the Catholic Church. It's a prayer app. And we're going to kind of go through the upsides and downsides of that app and how we can understand technology and relevance in light of our faith. But as we get started this morning, I do have a quote for you from theologian N.T. Wright in his book, Surprised by Hope, Around the Resurrection. We talk often about the fact that that tomb is empty, and so there is hope and future. And N.T. Wright says this, that the point of the resurrection is that the present bodily life is not valueless just because it will die. What you do with your body in the present matters, because God has a great future in store for it. What you do in the present, by painting or preaching, singing or sewing, praying or teaching, building hospitals, digging wells, campaigning for justice, writing poems, caring for the needy, loving your neighbor as yourself, all of that will last into God's beautiful future. These activities are not simply ways of making the present life a little less beastly, a little more bearable, until the day when we can leave it all behind. They are part of what we may call building for God's kingdom. Just a reminder again that we are part of that kingdom that knows no end, and what we do in the present matters into the future. It will ripple out in ways that we will see and not always see. So welcome everybody to Faith Radio Mornings. Carmen LaBurge is up next. That, of course, is the music of our good friend Carmen LaBurge, who hosts Connecting Faith here on the Faith Radio Network, doing such a great job taking the headlines and connecting them to our daily life. Good morning, Carmen.
Good morning, Peter.
So I woke up this morning driving in, and apparently we are broadcasting live from the Arctic Circle this morning. It was minus 11 on my car thermometer, Carmen.
All right, I'm going to pull out my phone. I just tell you this. I walked from my house to my little radio studio this morning, and I'm not even wearing socks, let alone a hat. So it says it's 21 here, but that can't possibly be true. Otherwise, I've developed a very hardy spirit, which is maybe possible.
Well, and one of the engineers here, Matt, came in and said it actually feels like minus 6 outside. And Carmen, I get to the point where, why don't you just tell me the temperature? You know, let's factor in all the humidity, factor in the wind, just tell me what it is outside.
Is your heart warm? Let's just go with that this morning. Oh. Let's just go with warm hearts and bright spirits today.
Well, Carmen, speaking with you early in the morning makes my heart warm. There's so much to get to, I know, this morning. Fun to get your perspective on so many of these topics. And one of them that you sent me has to do with the release of an app that the Pope released to help young people maybe gather together around technology and prayer. And I'm curious your thoughts on that, and specifically where the line is between relevance and sort of maybe we end up devaluing our faith a little bit too with technology. How are you processing some of these headlines?
So this is the Click to Pray app, and it was developed by the Roman Catholic Church to engage the next generation actively in the life of faith. And so that's positive. If you were to go to the Click to Pray app, which they have, surprisingly, the Vatican seems to know what it's doing here. It's actually a pretty good app. It's timely. It's up to date. It appears to load easily. Their goal is to literally have billions of people praying all around the globe. And you can pray every day. You can pray with other people in the network near you. There are these prayer campaigns. And you can also click to pray with the Pope about whatever the Pope is praying about. And so that would probably be the one, Peter, that I would find, you know, pretty interesting, because the Pope tends to elevate and lift up things that other people would view as expressly political. And so this intersection of what is political and what is, you know, what are the things of faith, you know, that's an interesting intersection for me. And so when we look at what the Pope is praying about, like right now, what he's lifting up on this prayer app, are the challenges that are being faced by humanity. So on his list right now, would be issues in Venezuela and inviting people to pray for the people of Venezuela, and for the church in Venezuela to be able to meet the challenges of, what looks like a very hostile transition in government. And then he's also inviting us to pray for migrants around the world, particularly those, internally displaced people in places around the globe where, you know, they are literally living outside in the kinds of temperatures that you and I are talking about. And so I do think that this global awareness that the Pope and the Vatican are lifting up through the use of this Click to Pray app, that's all very, very positive. The other thing I like, Peter, just think about how powerful what they're doing is in terms of the democratization of the faith. I mean, historically, people were not invited to pray with the Pope. They were invited to pray to the Pope or through the Pope. This is an invitation to pray with the Pope. And that's a democratization of the faith. That's an acknowledgement of what Protestants would call the priesthood of all believers in a way, frankly, I've never seen come forth from the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, and related to that, Carmen, it's fascinating because the technology has allowed for so many voices, and there's some real downsides to that because it's hard to know what voices anymore are authoritative. Are they the ones that went viral, or how do we discern those sorts of things? But the other maybe upside of this is, as you've mentioned, it does have the capacity to flatten some of the hierarchy that's there and those who hold power. And some of that can be really helpful because we, at the end of the day, like you said, we really are just a priesthood of all believers.
Absolutely. And so I think that the invitation to actually teach people to pray each day across particular subject matter areas, to pray with one another, to recognize that they are praying in alignment with their spiritual leadership, their acknowledged spiritual leadership, in this case the Pope, the fact that it's translated into literally every language under heaven, like there's some really cool stuff here that provides opportunity for each and every one of us to have conversations today. You know, who are we praying with? What are we praying for? Do we acknowledge this unity of the global body of Christ, and are we actively praying for members of it in all circumstances everywhere? So, say what you want about, you know, sort of the ongoing conversations that Protestants have with Catholics or that we all have with our Orthodox brothers and sisters. The reality is Christians are Christians, and at some point praying with and for one another is something that we have to lift up as a positive thing, particularly this emphasis on teaching the next generation to pray and inviting them into prayer with those of us who are somewhat older.
And where is the line, Carmen, as we do engage with the next generation and think about the kingdom moving forward, of using technology in our faith in these ways? I know that when I do maybe a sermon in a church on a Sunday these days, there sort of is an expectation that I will have a video, whether it's a YouTube video or a TED Talk, or there'll be some engagement with technology. And Carmen, is there a line between maintaining relevance and assuming relevance looks like culture versus relevance being that which is true that moves forward?
So I don't buy into that compulsion that every time that we stand up to talk in the context of any personal environment that we have to use technology in that context. I reject that. I feel like if I'm face-to-face with people, then I'm going to have face-to-face conversations, and we're going to open the Word of God together in ways relevant to those of us who are in the room. And so I don't invite the intrusion of technology at that level. However, I'm very aware that the next generation of people become uncomfortable if they're asked to put their phones away. And so I actually invite them, hey, get your phones out, get on whatever social you love where you interact with your people, and be an agent of transmitting the message that we're going to talk about right here in this room right now to everybody else. And so leveraging the technology for kingdom advancement and leveraging the technology for sharing what's going on in the heart and mind of an individual at the time and allowing them to use the social media platform that they have to be evangelical in a very positive sense of the term. I view that as really good. And so that's a positive way to use technology in the context of Christian conversation. There are obviously lots of negative influences of technology on us today. And limiting our use of technology, I think, is important just in terms of screen time and what it's doing to our brains.
It's the voice of Carmen LeBurge, who's the host of Connecting Faith here as part of the Faith Radio Network. Carmen, we'll take a break a little early here because we have lots more to get to, including some interesting stories about a wave of legislature that is coming forth to suggest that Bible classes need to be part of public schools. And, of course, that gets to be a very interesting and a conversation filled with a bit of tension on both sides. So I want to get your perspective on that next on Faith Radio Mornings. Minutes after the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. We're talking with Carmen LeBurge, as we do every Friday morning, about some of the important headlines of the day. And Carmen, I see that there's quite a few bills that are in process anyway to allow public schools to hold Bible classes. They're elective still and not compulsory, but to introduce the Bible back into the classroom.
So this is one of those stories that there are some times that I look at a headline and I say to myself, wow, the media is really, really excited about something. And so as a Christian, I'm totally capitalizing on that. But to suggest that bills presented in 6 of 50 states across the country is a wave of conservative legislation, like I'm not sure that 6 bills at the state level across the country constitutes a wave. But hey, the USA Today thinks it's a wave, so let's ride it as far as it takes us today. So this wave, quote unquote, of Bible literacy bills, which Bible literacy is in scare quotes in the lead to the article, a wave of Bible literacy bills is emerging in state legislatures, which would allow more students in public schools to study the Old and New Testaments. So I think this is one of those cases, Peter, where actually finding out what's happening in your own state is really important, and how you feel about the legislation that's specifically being presented there is really important. I do think that these should be elective courses. I certainly don't think they should be compulsory. I also think that, the high school level or the junior high level is the most appropriate place for these probably to be taught, because you and I both know, as things skew younger, we tend to be more directive in the way we're teaching something. And so once kids are at the stage where they're already making these kinds of decisions for themselves and they're sorting through competing worldviews, that's a good time to introduce this kind of curriculum. So, those would be the kinds of things that I would encourage people to be looking for in terms of what might be happening in your own state. We are talking about the provision to provide for an elective Bible course that teaches the Bible, teaches the Bible's literary and historical significance. So all of those things need to be kept in mind. And it's not being taught as a guidebook for a particular faith or religious expression. It's being taught in these elective courses for its literary and historical value. And so those would be things that I want Christians to know and be aware of. And as we have these conversations in the culture, let's be mindful that the same kind of legislation could be proposed, might be proposed, in relationship to other texts that other religious groups consider sacred. And so you have to be prepared for that conversation as well. Are you prepared for the Quran to be taught as an elective in your public school system? If you got to work through that conversation, and you would have to think through whether or not you're comfortable with that as you advocate for the Bible to be taught in the same way.
Well, living over in Scotland, Carmen, I know that this is part of the schools that are there, is that there's pretty significant historical takes on religious views and on values, and even the sacred texts of different religions. And I think for people that are really concerned that it would introduce other world religions, it might. But I didn't find a lot of fuss over in Scotland about these things. People explored different religious faiths, and it didn't mean that it was going to, that they were going to become adherents to a specific faith. But there's a lot of value to allowing the Bible to be in the classroom and be studied that way. And if we think it truly is the authentic word of God, it's going to likely change lives in those moments.
Absolutely. And I guess there's part of me that is immediately wondering, did you bring up Scotland so that we could talk about the fact that it's Burns Day?
Well, you know, I'll bring up Scotland for any reason. There's no, I never need an excuse, Carmen. I'm sitting here eating Scottish digestives in the studio this morning, so.
So, yeah, so the most famous poet in Scottish history, Robert Burns, today is the day that Scots all around the world celebrate him by eating food that I don't think is actually food. So there you go. And singing Auld Lang Syne. That's their thing today. So anyway, so world religions, I think that our kids are in an environment where there are lots of conversations about competing worldviews. Whether or not we as adults recognize that and are supportive of our kids being equipped, not just to defend a Christian worldview, but to understand competing worldviews, I am more well equipped to enter into conversations with secular people because I was educated among them. I am more prepared, I am more equipped to understand how somebody could be operating out of a worldview that is expressly non-Christian because I've spent a fair amount of time with people who aren't Christians. And so when we talk about public school and when we talk about our kids being educated in public school and we talk about the Bible being an elective course there where not only will other students who have no exposure to the Bible in any other environment because it's not something used in their homes and they're not going to church and it's not something that is lifted up in the culture as a positive reference point, it's not only good for them, it's good for our kids. It's good for Christian kids to understand the literary and historical significance of the Bible because in cultural conversations, particularly those that they are going to be having increasingly as they become adults and more or a higher and higher percentage of people in the culture do not associate with Christianity or have any background in it, this is an advantage to them to understand what the Bible is as a valuable and significant historical, a piece of literature. I mean, however you want to frame it, it actually equips our kids to be able to say, hey, this is an important book and there's really important stuff in here. And as a culture, we've actually grown up on the foundations of this book. And so we all should understand what's in it.
Voice of Carmen LeBurge. Carmen, one more topic to get into this morning that has to do with the fact in South Carolina, the government allows for a foster care group to keep a Protestants-only policy in their organization. And this really flies in the face of a Obama-era regulation that barred religious discrimination, or at least a perception of religious discrimination, in federally funded foster care programs. What did you see in this story?
So I expect to see this circle back around. I expect there to be quite a response, probably a litigious response to this. So the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, so we're talking actually here at the federal level, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has issued an exemption that allows all foster care agencies in South Carolina to actually disregard the Obama-era regulation that bars religious discrimination in federally funded foster care programs. So people who are listening right now, that if you've been paying attention to this unfolding narrative across the country where religiously affiliated adoption and foster care programs have been going out of business over the last handful of years after the Obama-era regulation that they were not allowed to apply their religious standards to the placement of children in homes, they just went out of business. And so in Massachusetts, it was, the Catholics, the biggest placement agency in the whole state, went out of business because they refused to place children in the homes of individuals who were living in ways that were expressly contrary to their faith. And so what happened in South Carolina is this one particular organization called Miracle Hill Ministries, which is based in Greenville, and it's huge. It's a huge organization. They were either going to go out of business and therefore stop supporting and training parents to be licensed by the state to receive foster care children, which, frankly, the state of South Carolina couldn't afford. They could not afford for this organization to stop doing what it's doing. And so they appealed to the federal government saying, we need an exemption. We in South Carolina need an exemption. Because we cannot afford for this religious nonprofit to go out of business and stop doing what they're doing in the placement of foster care kids. And so, or the training of parents to receive foster care kids. So anyway, they got the exemption. Well, I expect that to be a rolling tide now across the country. Other states are going to ask for this same exemption. Other states are going to point to this and say, hey, South Carolina. And they're going to get that exemption. And then, of course, we're going to see those who are absolutely contrary in every way, shape, and form to people's religious liberty being upheld in the face of what you and I both know is just sort of the sexual revolution, we're going to see a contest of this in the courts, would be my guess. But at this point, this is a pretty extraordinary win for religious liberty, and it's a win that was won outside of court simply by the issuance of an exemption from a federal government agency.
That's a fascinating story. And Carmen, we have about a minute left here. I just find it interesting how rare it is that religious regulations get rolled back like this. It just doesn't happen very often. And I can't imagine, like you said, it's going to be sort of left alone. There'll be some challenges to this moving forward.
Well, especially as narrow as this organization is. I mean, they come right out and say, we exist to be a mission arm of Protestant churches. So they're not even just talking about broad Christianity here. They're talking at a very narrow definition of who they're willing to equip to have kids placed in their homes.
Well, it's really going to be interesting to see this moving forward. Carmen, it's always great to speak with you on a Friday morning. I'd like to say stay warm down there where it's 22 degrees in Tennessee where you are. But given the fact it's minus 11, I can't find that other centeredness in the moment, Carmen.
Stay warm, my friend.
We'll take a break here for Lighten Up and some bottom of the hour news. And we come back for the second half of hour one here today. We'll speak with Gary Stratton about the importance of transitions in life and how we can navigate them. Some interesting news developments overnight. Roger Stone has been indicted by a grand jury on charges brought by special counsel Robert Mueller, who alleges that the longtime Donald Trump associate sought stolen emails from WikiLeaks that could damage Trump's opponents at the direction of, quote, a senior Trump campaign official. The indictment's wordings does not say who on the campaign knew about Stone's quest, but makes it clear it was multiple people. This is the first time prosecutors have alleged they know of additional people close to the president who worked with Roger Stone as he sought out WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. I'm sure next week on Faith Radio Mornings we'll cover this news as the situation warrants. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we are joined by Patty Crawford, who runs a healthcare center, and she discussed how to choose care for relatives with dementia or Alzheimer's and suggested that the one thing that is key is love.
Reading Stacy's book, I realized that the difference in adult day is that love is made visible.
Hmm.
We may market, it's not in the brochure, but families should look for that evidence of love because we do love those we serve. And that's with searching for any service for seniors. If you can't see the love, ignore the sofa. Look for the love.
Patty joined us in studio yesterday, and she was also alongside of Stacy Monson, who's an author of the book Open Circle, that deals with how to understand caring for our loved ones if they're heading into the very difficult journey of dementia or Alzheimer's. I know that it creates a lot of response because so many of us are impacted by just that. And so I'd recommend heading to myfaithradio.com, searching for that segment from yesterday's show, and hear all of their suggestions that they had as we move towards that kind of future together. Well, up next here on Faith Radio Mornings, we'll be joined by Dr. Gary Stratton of Johnson University for our Friday segment. Gary and I are going to respond to a listener text from last week about the dark night of the soul, and we're also going to talk a bit about how to handle transitions in life.
Supreme Court choices. Why is it so critical? This is Jim Garlow. When you analyze the problems that have gone on in our culture in recent years, it's not primarily what Congress has done, one of the branches of our government. When you understand what has been going on anti-scriptural, sometimes is coming out of the White House, admittedly. But if you really want to look at long-term, horrifically negative, anti-biblical impact on our nation, it's coming from the Supreme Court. Oh, not all the justices. Some of them there are godly and highly competent, and they honor the Constitution. I'm speaking about what has oftentimes been the majority of about five of them, who not only disregard the Constitution, but see themselves supreme over God, and as a result, violate what God has established on the earth. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
A Gary, I got to tell you, I was tempted to run that one all the way out, maybe a full 4 minutes or so. This is the last time you and I have a chance to do this kind of conversation in this specific role. I know there's the possibility you and I to do some things in the future together. I certainly enjoy working with you on a number of levels. But with my forthcoming transition out of the host chair here next Thursday, I won't be here for next Friday's segment. And certainly I've enjoyed the time, the wisdom, the experience, our ongoing relationship, all of that, Gary. You've just been great for the program.
Oh, man, it's been so great to do this with you, great to reconnect, and I just love your heart and your mind, Peter. This is just a blast.
Well, the feeling is certainly mutual, Gary, on every level. The conversations we have, I hope, really benefit the listeners first and foremost, but I know that I go home rich and full from them as well. And I know last week one of the topics that we covered was a bit about walking through the dark night of the soul. I know many of us are familiar, unfortunately, whether we have the actual language for it, we're familiar with the dark night of the soul in the sense that we're experiencing God's absence in our life and don't really know how to proceed or where to go. And so a listener texted from last time writing that, what about the soul's very painful seeming absence of God and the absence of intimacy with God during this time? And Gary, I just think about how you and I, we're all designed for intimacy. And when we experience its lack, it really is a painful process, isn't it?
It really is. And it's especially hard until you start to figure out what God's after, because it just seems almost mean that he withdraws for a while. He doesn't actually really withdraw, but it's because of the goal that he has for us that he acts the way he does. That his goal for us is that we could fully share in the love that the Father and Son and Spirit have shared eternally, that he wants that to come within us and for us to fully share in it. But to do that, it has to be genuine love. It can't be bought or sold or forced. So we always think about that being the robot problem. God can't create robots that say, I love you, I love you, I love you, and they really, really actually love him. He needs to give us freedom of the will of some sort or freedom of choice. But we often don't think about the bribery problem involved, that God can't – it's not genuine love. You say, I'll give you everything you want if you love me, because then it's about what I'm giving you, not about me. My friend Klaus Esser calls it the Bill Gates problem, that he got to be the richest man in the world by age 30, but he wasn't married. So how does the richest man in the world find true love? And it almost seems like it's impossible. Literature is full of the story where – the rich people, the king, the prince, the princess has to disguise themselves, hide themselves to go as a commoner to see if they can find true love. And that's why God hides himself in the dark nights of the soul.
And you reference the idea that there is that bribery problem. And I think it's such an important piece of this, Gary. And I know that Jesus says you can't serve two masters. You can't have a divided heart along those lines. And boy, it sure seems obvious when we talk about the big topics like, gosh, I don't want to serve my career. I don't want to serve my money, any of those sorts of things. But I think there's so many subtleties of the heart, Gary, that I am serving that I don't know. And I sort of expect that if I'm serving God in a certain kind of way, I'm going to get a proper kind of response. And I don't know your experience in those dark nights, but I know my experience in those long journeys of the dark nights is it's those things that get stripped away, and it isn't always easy.
No, it's not. It's just a natural thing. When we first start following God, we start following him and loving him for our own sake. We felt for what he does for us. And God wants to get us to that place where we love him for his own sake, for his own love. And so this dark night of the soul, some people say there's three versions. There's when God stops the dark night of provision. He stops answering your prayers in the ways that you want. Or there's the dark night of presence where God just doesn't seem as present as he was before. And it's very painful, like the listener talked about. And then John of the Cross said there's a double dark night of the soul where God's not answering your prayers and he doesn't seem to be present, and he just, all sense of him seems to be lost in the universe. But that's where we need to press in and seek him and to be present to him and express our love to him, even when we're not getting anything back in return.
The only thing that calms the waters of my soul, Gary, in those moments of the dark night is not all of a sudden the reemergence of God in an intimacy kind of place. It is a trust in God that God knows what he's doing, even if I'm experiencing his absence, and that I'm just going to keep pressing in, as you said. It sounds great when we talk about it on a radio show on a Friday morning, but it's exceedingly painful when you're in the midst of it. But I don't know any other way to have a sense of peace other than to lean in and trust and say, I trust you, God, even in your absence.
No, and I think, you know, John of the Cross said it was so helpful to me that, of course, there's no lights in those days. He talked about what happens in the dark night of the soul really is God's drawing near in a new way. It's like someone walking out of a darkened church into a bright sunlit day, and suddenly your eyes are blinded by it. But you're not blinded by darkness. You're blinded by the light. and that we kind of close ourselves off to it, and slowly we get accustomed to the fact that we're surrounded by light in a deeper way than ever before, and we start seeing God in everyone and everything in ways we never have before. And that only comes by his withdrawing his immediate presence and provision. Like you said, it's so painful.
It's the voice of Gary Stratton, who joins us each Friday here on Faith Radio Mornings. He's a professor of spiritual formation and cultural leadership at Johnson University. And Gary, let's take a short pause, and when we come back, we'll change the topic over to what we are going to cover for this day in terms of transitions. I know that people face transitions all throughout their life, some very small, some very large ones. And how do we walk through those times of uncertainty? So I'd love your perspective on that next on Faith Radio Mornings. Gary, Rachel Sutton here in the studio, is typically on point with the music, and that's a good one to roll in with on the dark night of the soul, where God is inviting us to see him fully and take the other things away.
No, and that's what he wants for us. And I mean, I would tell the listener to keep seeking the Lord. Like, this is such a precious time. You look back and see that it's one of the most wonderful times in your life, but it doesn't feel that way at the time. It was 7 years ago this spring that I remember I decided to give up prayer for Lent. That might sound really unspiritual, but what I realized is that I was praying an hour a day, but it was so much about me and asking what I wanted to eat or what I wanted for other things. And I just said, what I meant by giving a prayer is I'm just not going to ask you for anything for 46 days of Lent. But I kept praying. I kept meditating on scripture. I kept singing worship songs, taking long walks, going up to the top. Like, I learned to connect with him with an intimacy I had never imagined possible.
One more thought on this, Gary. Author Tim Farrington, in A Meditation on Depression and the Dark Night of the Soul, says this, that you don't need to retire to a cloister or to the desert for years on end to experience a true dark night. You don't even have to be pursuing any particular spiritual path. For raising a challenged child or caring for a failing parent for years on end is at least as purgative as donning robes and shaving one's head. To endure a mediocre work situation for the sake of a paycheck that sustains family demands at least as much in the way of daily surrender to years of pristine silence in a monastery. No one can know in advance how and where the night will come or what form God's darkness will take.
Amen. Great word.
And I think so many of us that just are feeling sort of the rigors of a daily life that can feel so mediocre, it isn't. All of these moments are sacred opportunities to move towards God.
No, they are. And that's really where the soul cuts ice with God, is in these times, not in the bright, sunlit, beautiful mountaintop experiences, but in these dark nights and these valleys.
Well, one topic I wanted to get to with you this morning, Gary, is as we're transitioning out of the role of the morning show host and doing some other work for the Faith Radio Network moving forward, transitions are just part of life, aren't they? I mean, we can't always expect them. We don't anticipate them. This one I've anticipated for a while, but sometimes it might be the sudden death of a loved one, or it might be the loss of a job. It might be a relationship ending. And transitions are those places where you no longer are what you were and you're not yet what you're going to be related to it. And so they're tricky places, aren't they?
No, they are. I mean, it's whether you've chosen it or it's chosen you, there's always grief involved in a transition. Even going from a bad job to a great job, there's still grief involved because there's death to relationships and routines and things. So to let ourselves grieve, to let ourselves feel sorrow, to let ourselves feel anger, to let ourselves feel kind of numb sometimes about things and just work our way through that and let each one of those things draw us to God, man, that's the only way to make it through transition.
Well, and I think, I don't know about what your experience is, Gary, and you've gone through transitions for work and any number of things too, but there's a sense in which we build our understanding of ourself around our experiences and our environment and our circumstances. And that's part of what gets to be destabilizing about a transition, is that how we understood ourselves just because of the circumstances around us, it gets stripped away. And is there an invitation in there to maybe understand our sense of identity from a more anchored standpoint?
Yes, I think so. Early in our walk with the Lord, my wife Sue is a motto maker, and she came with the motto that no one actually ever becomes truly spiritually mature. They simply become comfortable in their environment. And boy, you just change someone's environment and whoa, suddenly you're having to rethink through everything spiritually and how to redo spiritual disciplines and how to walk with God through everything. So it's just part of life.
When there is a relationship fracture, Gary, whether it's the failure of a marriage or something happens with the kids and you fear that you may not see them again, how do you sustain it in those places? Because this is another place where the dark night can come in, is in the midst of some of those really painful transitions.
No, it really is. I think sometimes it helps me to read scripture, especially the Old Testament, with the idea that the ancients saw themselves walking into the future, not forward like we do, but backwards. The past is what's really clear, if you can see that, but the future is unseen, so you're literally walking backwards into the future. So when Isaiah says, whether you turn to the right or the left, you'll hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. And it suddenly makes sense. Oh, God's walking in this dark place, land that we can't see him, but he's guiding us, directing us along the way. And to cling to that in the midst of these times of transitions, which can be dark nights of the soul all by themselves.
Well, I think one of the transitions a lot of parents obviously face is when their kids get older and they maybe get to 18, 19, 20, 21, somewhere in that neighborhood, and there gets to be a shift in the relationship where you are the primary mm-hmm. shepherd towards more of a friendship. You're still shepherding. I know we're going through some of that right now with my son, Caleb, who just turned 19, and we just so love the relationship. But, it, you know, there can be rough patches for, I think, a lot of families as they're kids get to be seniors in high school and the kids themselves. I remember, Gary, I thought, wow, what is happening in my life? I don't even know and understand what the world's going to be next year when I go to school. And some of these transitions, you've walked through this with your kids as well. How do you do this well when your kids are transitioning from maybe being an adolescent to more of an adult?
Oh, man, it's such as treating them like an adult is the biggest challenge. I mean, that we want to transition from an adult-child relationship into an adult-adult relationship. And the only way to do that is to go out of our ways to treat them like adults, to give them advice, but to give them counsel when they ask for it. Not tell them this is what you should do, but here's some things you might want to think about in your decision. This is your decision. And to support them when they make bad decisions, because the only way to learn wisdom is to make bad decisions and to not shame them for it, but to be there to nurture them. It is a whole different journey of parenting at that moment.
Well, the difference between advice and counseling is, oh dear, I will say this, I try to give counsel at times, Gary, but it's sort of passive aggressive advice way too often. If you're really going to give counsel, you need to have some open hands and say, here are some things to think about and let them make those decisions. My counsel too often is, here's some things to think about and you better make that decision.
Oh, yeah. My mom is a master of that, double messaging. You can do that if you want. You can't win then, you know. So, yeah, we don't ever put our kids in that shameful bind.
And with our kids, too, how important is it at a young age to introduce them to other voices of authority in their lives that can maybe be voices in important transitions? If you have a bit of a fracture in a relationship with your child, and I know many parents experience this, especially during the adolescent years, but to build other voices around them intentionally, especially at an early age, you might end up with somebody, a youth pastor or a friend or somebody who can speak some things with your child in those moments where maybe you've lost your voice for a season.
No, it's true. I mean, there's something in the wiring that God's put into us that somewhere in our adolescence, we stop being interested in the voice of our parents as being our primary authorities, and we start looking for other significant relationships. I think it's one of the dilemmas of in our peer-driven relationship and our media-driven relationship. It's really easy for students to turn just to peers or just to media to get that advice. So most cultures send adolescents, young men, away to be raised by uncles during this time period. And a lot send their daughters away to be raised by aunts because you just are open to things. So having aunts and uncles, whether they're literal or spiritual in their life, that they have access to, that they have freedom to go talk to, that you don't feel like there's something wrong, they don't feel like you don't approve of them having this relationship, that is so key.
Well, I know how much my son Caleb enjoys your counsel, Gary. Maybe you should become Uncle Stratton in our family. I can just send him your direction. Is that okay? You can raise him for
right.
the next
okay.
maybe 5 years.
Uncle Gary, man. That's good. I'm there. Uncle Gary, anytime, man.
Hey, one more thought on this before we wrap things up. One of the obviously most difficult transitions is the transition from life to death and then back to life again. And boy, there is such an uncertainty that represents all transitions in terms of you don't know what the future is going to hold. And I don't know of any other way through the transition through death, Gary, than to point out what Jesus sit on the cross. And at the end of all of those things, he just said, okay, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. There is some practice in the transitions of life that allows us to enter into that final transition in a different kind of way, aren't there?
No, there is. And that's, I mean, to some degree, you know, the Puritans used to say that all of life is simply preparing for death, you know, to die well, to die connected to the Lord, to die without fear is kind of the goal of spiritual maturity. And, you know, it seems morbid to us, but in their culture where the average life expectancy was like 38, it made a lot of sense. And I think even as our life expectancy get longer today, I think it probably is a good perspective.
Well, Gary, can't tell you again how much I appreciate your time, spending the time that you have on these Friday mornings to give us such great perspective of wisdom and true counsel on these mornings. I know that I've heard from many listeners about how much they appreciate it and look forward to whatever the future holds in this transition. I know that our relationship will continue, and I just appreciate your voice of wisdom and insight and all of what you bring.
Well, Peter, I have just so enjoyed this, enjoyed being part of your listeners' lives, and my wife will tell you that I look forward to getting up early on Friday morning and getting some time with you. So we got to find other ways to hang out, whether that's retreats, podcasts, other things. Let's do it.
I love it. Well, I will be playing Shut Up and Dance with Me throughout my car, I'm sure, all weekend as I grieve, Gary. Great to talk with you again this morning. And we'll take a break here and wrap up our first hour of the show and preview what's coming up in Hour 2 on Faith Radio Mornings. I met Gary Stratton about 17 years ago at a local university and just connected and clicked right in those moments. He's one of those people that's just part of the bigger story of faith. It's part of what we celebrate here on Faith Radio Mornings, is recognizing that we do have our stories, but they're connected to a much bigger story that has gone on way before us, will continue way after us, because we are part of a kingdom that knows no end. And, of course, Hour 2 here on Friday morning, we'll start with Adam Holtz of PluggedIn.com, and Adam and I will talk about some of the recent released movies in our day.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.